I can turn on the actual recording. And yeah, all right. So the secret of the higher initiations lies in the trained use of the higher will. It does not lie in purification or self-discipline or in any of the expedients which have acted in the past as interceptors of the truth. Now, what could we mean by the trained use of the higher will? What could we mean by that? In other words, who's receiving the training? There's the reception of the higher will, and then there's the use of the higher will. Yeah? How do you train yourself in the use of the higher will? How do you train? I'll tell you what I'm going to do. That's what that is. Yeah. Well, what do you mean, try it? Yeah, I put it down to the right. I put it down to the right. This, you see? It's quite high. Quite high. Quite high. Test, test. All right, we just, you know, if I get obsessed by this, it won't do any good. I'm just trying to get rid of my Skype here. Control, Alt, Delete. Sorry for the delay here. It's just, okay. End task. End now. End. All right. Trained use of the higher will. What actually is that? If you think of yourself, are we trained in the use of the will? How would we go about training ourselves in the use of any will? First is to know what it is, right? It is first felt through. Okay, there is a whole element of will that is felt on that line of 1, 3, 5, 7 and through the mental body. And, you know, I would say it is commonly felt through the mental body. Whether it is first felt through there, I suppose, depends on the individual. There is a driving something which I would like to define. It's in the rays and the initiations. And it has to do, I really should one day memorize the page. Will to good. Will to good, and it is inevitable. Let's try that. No, this is not it. Does anybody know where that will quote is? I have it here in my other computer. Oh, it's this marvelous discussion of the will to good, and the will in general. Let's see, maybe here, Denmark. Okay, so it's Raise Initiations, Denmark. Okay, maybe I'll find it. No. It's in Rays and the Initiations. And this is so frustrating because I have all these things lined up here. You have found it? You will find it. Rays and Initiations. Okay. I know where I go. I know where to go. It's nice to know where to go. Okay, this is this is faculty, because I'm working on this with the faculty right now. Webinar for faculty discussion. Okay, backup, full faculty webinar. What does it mean? The will to good, the will to good. I'm sorry for this. There it is. Okay. Here it is. Oh, goodness. Blinding conviction. Oh, what page is it on? It is on page 175 and 176. All right, let's look at that. Because this gives us an idea about this higher use of the will. Okay. All right. We contact Shambhala for the first time at the third initiation. So it tells us here, for the first time, the focus purpose which brought Sanat Kumara into incarnation makes its impact upon the enlightened brain of the initiate. Now, let's look at our very first rule. Enlightened brain, right? Within the fire of mind, focused within the head's clear light, let the group stand. Enlightened brain. Not just enlightened mind. It makes an impact upon the enlightened brain of the initiate, bringing something new and different into his equipment, into his nature and his consciousness. See, the trained use of the higher will. So how do we train the use of the higher will? I know not else how to express the ideas. And here's what comes into his consciousness with the third degree and the touch of the monad and the beginning of the use of the higher will. And this is very, very powerful. I'm going to even underline it. It is a blinding conviction of unalterable will, carrying all before it, oblivious of time and space, aware only of intensity of direction, and carrying with it two major qualifications or basic recognitions to the initiate. A sense of essential being, which obliterates all actions and reactions of time and space, and a focused will to good, which is so dynamic in its effect that evil disappears. Evil is, after all, only an impelling sense of difference leading inevitably to separative action. Interesting definition of evil. So with the touching of the Lord of the world, the one initiator, for the first time, the quality of the monad is brought in with these effects. So when we're training the higher will, it is sometimes so that in people, this sense of irresistible power begins to arise, even before it reaches the mind and, you know, how to direct it, how to arrange it, how to apply it. It's a great dynamic energy, maybe accompanied by a vision, a sense of strength, irresistibility, and the sense that it's not about your personal desires, the appearance of this energy. It's about something higher in a larger sphere which is needing to be done. Then, of course, the mind can get a hold of it and say, and this is how we will do it, and arranging the energy in a certain way in the world. Because, you know, basically the mind moves things around according to your intention. The mind is a creative mover. There are many ways to describe it. But the principle of activity is associated with the mind. The principle of magnetism with love, and the principle of power with the will. So I'm going to reread this because it's so important. It is a blinding conviction of unalterable will. Now, the word unalterable means it cannot change. You know, a wind cannot come and change its direction. Nobody is going to come and say, I don't think it's right, we should do it this way. This is decided by a higher force, because it's a higher will, carrying all before it, meaning nothing can resist this type of will on our planet, this type of directed energy, and not being concerned or even registering time and space. When the condition of will exists, time becomes a moment, an eternal moment that we sometimes call eternal now, and space becomes a point. So, you know, how do you take the fourth initiation? Well, you can't take it. None of us can if we are still the victim of the sense of time and space. We have to collapse time and collapse space, and then we can get through the eye of the needle now. Right now. You know, it's very interesting. In the fourth ray technique of integration, the last words are, the hour is now. And when you look at the mountain, which ends on the Buddhic plain, it's called the mountain whereon form dies. Time, space, and form, they all go together. But being does not. So will doesn't care what's happening in relative time, in relative space. It just doesn't care. It is so intent on its object and the direction of its object that it moves everything out of the way. It's aware only of intensity of direction. It's an interesting phrase, isn't it? Intensity of direction. Well, you might say it's aware of direction, but it intensely intends to pursue only that direction to such an extent that it doesn't make any difference what time it is. It doesn't make any difference what is the arrangement in space that may seem to interfere. It only is the perpetrator of the will and the object of the will, and carries two major qualifications or basic recognitions to the initiate. And these are the kinds of things I always say that it's very simple to take the third initiation. Just have a cup of tea. Just live in the eternal and know the self as one. That's all. You want to take the third degree, live in the eternal, know the self as one. Collapse time into the eternal now, collapse space into the dimensionless point, no problem. And then, you know, how many lives does it take to ponder on those things before, you know, they are real to us? So this incredible, and you must always remember this page, 175 and 176, because I will always forget it. There's other pages I remember, but when it comes to the will, I forget. Oh, why is that? Anyway, the will, touching Shambhala, Sanatkumara, conveys a sense of essential being which obliterates all actions and reactions of time and space. Now, remember Rule 9. You've all studied the 14 rules, so let the group know there are no other selves. Let the group know there is no color, only light. And then let darkness take the place of light, and here's the point, hiding all difference, blotting out all form. Hiding all difference, blotting out all form. That doesn't mean that the master is going around in a daze and cannot handle the illusions of time and space, but something in the master knows that there is no difference, and the essential being is so real, so powerful, so overwhelming that form is barely perceived as form. It's like essential being takes over the entire perceptual apparatus. A sense of a being which is so strong that it obliterates. You know what the word obliterate mean? It means like destroy completely. You know, you can half destroy something, you can break it up a little bit. Obliterate is like in many little pieces, so all that's left is dust, or not even that. So the will comes along and says, being is, God is, you know, and ultimately I am, and the presence is. All of these things are the main thing perceived. Being is perceived. And everything else is a secondary derivative of pure being. Being descends to manifest. Remember, time is. Being descends to manifest. Creation is. Time then and form agree. Being and time do not agree. Okay. So, normally, people like ourselves, what time is it? How much time have we got left? Where are you going? Where are you coming from? When do you have to leave? When are you arriving? Time and space, right? This category of consciousness, these two, we call time and space. We govern all of our life as if time and space are real things. But what happens when you compare any unit of time, no matter how lengthy, to eternity? What is the ratio of, let us say, any unit of time to infinity, eternity? It doesn't make any difference how big the unit of time is. When compared with eternity, it becomes next to nothing and infinitesimal. So when we see through the illusions of time, we begin to live in the eternal. And we begin to see through the illusions of time when the sense of the presence of God is so strong, or the presence of the presence, the one thing, that it blots out all considerations of our normal time, space, mind. See, to be an initiate of the fourth degree, the time, space, mind has to go. It doesn't mean you can't handle time and space, but you recognize them as illusions and something else is much more real. So that comes at the third degree, this sense of essential being. You're living in the presence, you are the presence, there's only the presence, regardless of all the rest of it, which is the accompanying illusion. It doesn't mean that you cannot be intelligent in the world of illusion. Of course you can be. But there's another and deeper registration of what is reality. And that changes at the third degree. And then is confirmed by the fourth degree. And then comes another gift. Such a focused will to good, which is so powerful, so dynamic, that all evil disappears. So somehow this will to good overcomes all difference, because that's how DK defines evil. A sense of difference which makes you act. It pushes you, this sense of difference which drives you towards separative action. In other words, he says a very interesting thing about the Black Lodge. He says, they are brothers. Yes, they are brothers. But they are brothers who have wandered very far into the land of distances. Wandered very far into the land of distances. Well, that means that they have separated themselves, they've separated their consciousness from the perception of inviolable unity. They have a separative consciousness, and sure enough, their main field of consciousness is the encapsulated concrete mind, filled with distinction, difference, separation. They never penetrated the veil of separation, which is one of the, you know, the veil of impulsion, the veil of distortion, the veil of separation, and the veil of aspiration. Those are the four veils on the etheric plane. They can't get beyond it. So they can't take the third degree along the Sirian line. So what is this will to good? So, you know, now inevitably this is going to lead us into the question, what is the good? And we might as well be back there with Plato and Socrates 2,500 years ago discussing this. To the sun. We're very fortunate that Gisla is so well trained in academic philosophy, because he can pull up for us the major thoughts that the major philosophers have had, you know, over the period of Western civilization. The sun. I would say, you know, books have been written on what is the good, but I would equate the good within any system with the purpose of the hierarch of that system. The good for the planetary sphere is the purpose of the planetary logos. The good for the solar logos is the purpose of the solar logos, good of the solar system. The good of the local cosmosphere, consisting of seven major suns, is the good of the local cosmic logos. Good is a relative term, and it has to do with the confined system to which it applies. So no good is ultimate good. Finally, what is universal good? It is the purpose and all that leads to the enactment of that purpose of the universal logos, the one God of the one present solar system. Is that ultimate good? It's only ultimate with respect to the particular universe we're dealing with. That universe is transient and a thing of time, and is reabsorbed into the absolute, where all qualities are found, including the absolute essence of that being, non-being, and that's where the ultimate good is going to be found. So the good is interesting to me. Good is a relationship, a pattern. The good is the second aspect of the first aspect. The will to good is like the second ray expression of first ray will. It is a will, a driving power, towards the pattern which is conceived by the hierarch of our system. Here is in God's mind, let's call God the planetary logos for a moment, okay? In God's mind is a divine pattern, a standing wave, a relationship in the world of being which represents for God, the planetary logos, the consummation of his efforts, its efforts, whatever. It's male, female, divine, hermaphrodite. Everything that tends towards the approximation or the lower registration of that conception in the mind of the hierarch, God, is good. It's good, it's good, it's good you're doing this, it's good you're moving in the right direction, that's good, this is good. So many actions which bring things together to create a pattern which reflects God's conception, this is good. And the ultimate good for any system is itself the pattern which God has conceived and which every other factor finally imitates as perfectly as possible. The more congruent things are in the world of becoming with the world of being, the gooder they are, the better they are. So it's a question of pattern. And ray two is the ray of the divine pattern. And there's the good, the true, and the beautiful, or actually in the order that they come, the good, the beautiful, and the true. And the good is considered to be on the first ray, but it's a second ray aspect of the first ray, because it has to do with pattern and relationship. So here is this will to good, which means that on the, let's say, on the logoic plane, in terms of the cosmic physical plane, is some kind of divine idea that the planetary logos has conceived. That idea, that relationship, that pattern of energies eventually will direct all the lower energies so that all the lower energies reflect the pattern of energies which is held in the ideation or the mind of God. That is the good. So when you have a will to good, it is the power which will drive all things that you can control, and even what you cannot control, towards that arrangement. The power that drives towards the arrangement of God's idea is the will to good. And, of course, when everything is in right relationship, it's in relationship, it's connected. And evil is, you know, chopping all things into pieces. It's like Typhon in Egyptian mythology. What did he do? He came along and he chopped his brother Osiris into a bunch of pieces. Then Isis, who is Sirius, has to put it all back together. So the Black Lodge is like Typhon and wants everything to stay separate so they can control all the little parts and pieces. But there is a pattern that puts everything back together. And this will to good is that driving force which brings things into a relationship, that relationship reflecting God's perfect idea for his system. Now, when I say perfect, I mean relatively perfect, because there is no perfection in universe, and even the universe is imperfect. Because the word perfect, in English at least, really means complete. And, you know, the universe is the one, and the absolute is the infinity of finities. So what's complete about a universe? Nothing. But it's relatively perfect. In other words, within the intention of the design, it is perfect. So this is the kind of thing that starts to come into us when we are taking our first contact with Shambhala, our first contact with the monad, our first contact with the will aspect. These kinds of things begin to become real in our consciousness. Otherwise, we're just playing around in time and space, which are illusions. All is illusion, O brother in the shadows. Come forth into the light of day. Display the hidden glory of the Blessed One, the glory of the one and only. See, this is the third ray monad, the formula for the third ray monad. You know, when you look in your esoteric psychology book and you see early on in the game, you see the Blessed One. He is not. He flashes forth and yet does not. All that. This is the story of the monad. And then it gives you seven stanzas for seven blessed ones. And every blessed one of them is a monad. Every blessed one is a monad. So actually, DK has begun to give us, I think, some of the key to monadic psychology. And probably when you study the blessed ones, you can study your own monadic ray, one of the seven, and eventually one of the three. Okay, so that's a little exposition on the secret of the higher initiations lies in the trained use of the higher will. What it means is bringing through the higher intention, aligning your personal will, which is soul-infused, with the higher intention in such a way that something practical can happen in the world which is in line with this higher intention. You can't do everything at once. You know, here's the, oh, look what's supposed to be done. But you just have one little piece, only one little piece of that job to do. You know, work with the plan, it says, for the seventh ray type, focus on your share in that great work. It's all about your share. So that's what the trained use of the higher will is. It means the intelligent, well-ordered, practical use of the impression that the higher will gives to you, and knowing how to bring it into expression without, you know, sticking your finger in the electric socket. You know, if there's too much energy and you say, oh, look at this, you know, then you just blow up and nothing happens. So there's a training is a very Saturn thing, very seventh ray thing. And when you train, you figure out how much the form can take. Okay, so if you're going to run a marathon, do you train by running a marathon every day? You don't, do you? You build up slowly, 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 a little more, a little more, a little more, till the form can take it. And that's the same thing with the trained use of the higher will. He says, look, I've written down here, the trained use of the power which brings about that which must be. Because whatever the hierarch of a system says, if the planetary logo says it, it must be. That's the law. The law reflects the will of the hierarch of any system. When I use the word hierarch, I mean like a pyramid. At the top of the pyramid is the hierarch. And that point that is the hierarch is in every other point in the pyramid. So what the hierarch says goes. And we just have to figure out the intelligent way that we can make it happen, because if it tries to happen too quickly, the form is destroyed. You know what can happen with the first ray? Well, do this, do it now. You know, or stay up 1 hour more or whatever, you know. Push, push, push. DK says that if the average man contacts Shambhala prematurely, it will damage him. And if the disciple contacts Shambhala prematurely, it will destroy him. The difference between damage and destruction is real. So in Shambhala, one of the names of the first ray is the finger of God, or the touch. It's something about the touch which touches and then with the power that touches and then withdraws. Something like that. I want to get that. He says, you know, Shambhala really measures very carefully anything that it does. Here it is. That was ray three. And we go back quickly to ray one. Is there not a ray one here someplace? Have I gone too far? It is esoteric psychology. Somewhere this is. Well, I don't know. It should be there. It should be right there. Oh, there it is. That was the keeper of the records. Have I erased everything that came before that? You don't suppose I've erased all this? You know, you can do that by mistake. You can erase things, and then you have a problem. Well, I will... it seems like I'm being slowed down here. It looks like something has been erased. I don't like that. when I see that in my Alice Bailey book. Okay, so, but I can find it in another way. This is a computer, and it goes to D, and it goes to, oh, okay, it goes to, is this D? It goes to 1. Just bear with me. Sorry. That's quite a shock to see that happen. I have something I call memorization here. And the purposes of deity, and here is the first purpose of deity, and here are the names. And I think it's called the power that touches and withdraws. And it's also called, I think the finger of God is here. Yeah, there it is, the finger of God. You understand? Shambhala doesn't touch something and hold it there. Bzzz. No, it's just like an exquisitely measured touch. So that's how we have to train ourselves in this use of the will. Not to take on too much, but only what the form can actually withstand. Otherwise, we as disciples, we will destroy ourselves. That's what he basically says. And you can see, you know, sometimes, I guess, when you look at what happened to Madame Blavatsky, you know, I guess she wouldn't stop under any circumstance. So, you know, maybe she died young and younger than she needed to, and the story goes that it was intended there would be another volume or 3 volumes of The Secret Doctrine, something of that. They never got written, you know. Certain things Alice Bailey was supposed to write, they never got written. So we have to be very careful here. Okay. Going on. I'm glad I discovered that. I want to make a note that the will is missing from my Alice Bailey books. I guess, you know, I have separation anxiety here or something. I consider certain things holy. The Alice Bailey CD-ROM qualifies. All right, onward. So the secret of the higher initiations lies in the trained use of the higher will, not just the personal will. It's acquiescence. The secret of the higher initiations does not lie in dedication or self-discipline, or in any of the expedients, meaning things that are just sort of convenient along the way, which have acted in the past as interceptors of the truth. What does that mean to us about self-discipline and purification? Does it mean they're not important? It means that they are expected as a foundation right from the very beginning. The whole problem of the shambolic will is in process of revelation and will eventually alter the entire approach of the disciple to the new in the new age to initiation. The theme of the way into Shambhala requires reflective study and esoteric understanding. How do you think that the approach of the disciple in the New Age to initiation will be altered when we know more about the shambolic will? What do you think about that? You know, discipleship is always changing. It used to be the guru approach, right? You put yourself in the control of the guru, you do everything the guru says, the guru takes responsibility, okay. But that changed, right? So how did it change now? And still another change is coming. What is modern discipleship like now compared with the guru? One place he stays in one of the rules. It's amazing. Right. The demand for the higher initiations has now even gone back. Disciples. Yeah. So the higher demands become lower demands, or it's always rising. The lower demands always have to be replaced by still higher demands. Exactly. What the secret things before are now common knowledge. Well, you know, I think, suppose that you were really studying the Shambhalic will and it was meaningful to you. It was an energy you recognized in your life, excuse me, and in your group life. How would this change your present approach to discipleship now? If the Shambhalic will, as we've been describing it here, this irresistible force and all of that, how would discipleship change? Remember, what I just talked about was the six-ray approach. Oh, Guru, take care of me. I'll do everything you say. Okay. So that was the old way, and the Guru accepted the responsibility because you obeyed the Guru implicitly. Do this, I do it. Okay. Now, how do we pursue our discipleship? We, modern, Western man, reasonably intelligent and independent. What's our discipleship like now compared to that other way? Test, test. Yeah. We find we look within our own nature. We turn within instead of to the outer guru. We turn to the, in a way, to the inner guru, whatever, our own intuition. It means the teaching that comes from within. Tuition is teaching. In is in. Intuition. The teaching which comes from within. And we obey that and do it in the outer world according to our own responsibility. We're not handing over our responsibility to anyone else, are we? We're not saying, you know, through devotion, the guru will lift me, do this and all that. Well, you know, to a certain extent, they do, of course. But we take our own responsibility now, and we are studying our own way, and we are deciding ourselves, aren't we? Wouldn't you say that when the will takes over, and the Shambhalic will is in process of revelation, that the disciple will not just be applying to the soul. Soul contact will be expected, and it will be superseded. And something else, another objective, will come in instead. Wouldn't you say so? And to what extent, and how would it be different in our practical living as disciples if the Shambhalic will were the driving force? Can we contrast that or get the sense of what that might be like? It would be a much more intense life, wouldn't it? Much more group-oriented, wouldn't it? Much more sacrificial, wouldn't it be? And we would become much more a part of feeling to be a part of the planetary logos and working as an extension of the planetary logos, don't you think? And we would be cultivating the spiritual triad and the spiritual triadic states all the time. And we would think in planetary terms, don't you think? And we would be acting in planetary terms as well. What do they say? Think globally and act locally? I forget what that is, but that's one of the groups that designed that mantra. So obviously we're not there yet. But the will aspect, we would be cultivating the sacrifice petals. We would be thinking in terms of synthesis. We would be seeing things whole. The new discipleship, it may be that approach to the third initiation one day will even just be discipleship. And now we call it initiation, like you were saying. It might be that true initiation becomes the fifth degree. Everything keeps on evolving. You know, our whole solar system is driving through space. When you look out, everything looks the same in our solar system. Everything's revolving, everything, all as it is. But it's changed its position in space. Even though inside the solar system, everything looks the same, in relation to everything else, things have changed. So the whole solar system is moving on. And, you know, let's say it's moving up. That's why the requirements continue to change and become stiffer. DK says the disciple of the modern era is more intelligent than the disciple of the past. And maybe we'll say the disciple of the future era embodies much more of the divine will than we do as disciples of the present. Okay. So the way into Shambhala requires reflective study and esoteric understanding. And he actually said, couldn't there be found a group that would take this as their project? It would have to be, I think, a very special group, you know, consisting of people who had a lot of first ray in their system, I would think. So it requires reflective study, like you study and you open yourself to the higher impression to find the way. Well, you know, really, the way into Shambhala, in a certain sense, the Antikarana is the way into Shambhala. See, where is Shambhala? You know, is it in the Gobi Desert? You know, is it the White Island and all of that? That's just a lower reflection, isn't it? When you're really looking for Shambhala, and a lot of people do, they go looking for Shambhala, you know. They go to Mongolia and they say, you know, Shambhala or bust, they're going to find Shambhala. I don't know, do they find Shambhala? I'm sure they find something. To me, all of this is Shambhala. The four gates of Shambhala are the four subplanes, the higher four subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. The highest parts of Shambhala, where the Lord of the world is focused, are here. As a matter of fact, even the Christ and the Buddha are focused here, and the Lord of the world is found on the highest or seventh plane. But once you enter the cosmic ethers, you are entering the realm of Shambhala.
How would you define the difference of the divine and the monadic plane?
The divine plane is simpler and more archetypal than the monadic plane. The divine plane is characterized by three in one. Three logoi are focused on the divine plane. The Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, that's their home. The three great beings, each of whom uses three planetary logoi for expression, are focused on the logoic plane. I'll show you the map which kind of confirms that. Here. Here's the three, and it says the three logoi. This is not just Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune are still found here, as far as I can understand. The three logoi are the three persons of the Trinity. And a state of simplification exists on the highest level of Shambhala. It's where the council chamber is. Now, let's read that description of the energies of Shambhala. And we'll say, well, how do you define the difference between the monadic plane and what the highest level of Shambhala may be, or the divine plane? And if I can find it, Wow. Okay, it's in the AAB extracts. So I hope I can find this. Shambhala. Patterns. And it's very beautiful. And the question is, will we find it? Because it kind of, no, it says searching. Oh, it's taking a long time, unfortunately. I think what I'm going to do is forget this and do an old-fashioned search. Old-fashioned search is as follows. Okay, read it, read it. Okay, well, that's a very beautiful one. It's yes, is it 276 of this book? Here it is. This is the one. Is it the same? 293 of Dyna 2. It is a world of pure energy, of light, and of directed force. It can be seen as streams and centers of force, all forming a pattern of consummate beauty, all potently invocative of the world of the soul and of the world of phenomena. It therefore constitutes, in a very real sense, the world of causes and of initiation. Actually, there's a fellow, very good student down south. His name is Zachary Rymill. He's made a compilation of Shambhala with over 700 references. And I have it, and you may have it as well and not know it. I've given to you oftentimes what I call the AAB extracts. And I include those compilations, this fantastic compilation on Shambhala. So the ones you were reading are very good. Here's what I was trying to relate it, though, to the patterns of energy, the kind of patterns you find. And it's in a different book. But it says, notice it's a singular word. It says a pattern of consummate beauty. So there's a single pattern in this world of causes on the logoic plane, which tries to invoke that same pattern to be reflected in all the lower worlds. So I would just say it has to do with the complexity of the pattern, the unitariness of the pattern. I would say also, in terms of sound, that the letter A, ah, is sounding on the divine plane, and the letter U, or AU together, is sounding on the monadic plane, AU or O. But the pure father aspect of the Shiva note, A, is what characterizes the structure of Shambhala. And what's really interesting? Look at the letter A. I just thought of this, like this. Okay? So here's 1, 3, 2. The letter A, 1, 3, 2. The letter A is the three in one. It is the Trinity. It is God the Father as three and one. So this is found on the highest level of the logoic plane. And we saw from this diagram that the three persons of the Trinity are there. The three logoi, the three cosmic logoi, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. But those three are one. And that's also the plane of the A, the A, the Shiva note. So, you know, what can I say? I don't hang up out on the monadic plane or the logoic plane yet. How are they different? They look to me different in differentiation. And if I was to look at the tree of life or the Kabbalah, I would say that Kether, Chochmah, and Bina, the supernal trinity, are found on the logoic plane, and the other seven Sephiroth are found on the monadic plane, or at least the archetypes of them, and then, of course, they descend and are expressed in lower worlds. Okay, now I know it's getting there. We just have a little bit more. Okay. Here we are. So, in this concept of the new and future section of the way or path, which is based on the study of the divine will and the reception of the divine will and the acquiescence to the divine will, it is this concept with which the modern disciple is faced, and in it lies the secret of the coming revelation. And I put in here the coming revelation and of the spiritual dispensation which will emerge as humanity constructs the new world civilization and begins to formulate the new culture. And I brought in here this idea of the first purpose of Sanat Kumara. And DK describes it. It's in the Raised Initiations. I don't know. Is it around page, 251 or somewhere around there? The unknown, unseen, unheard purpose of Sanat Kumara. This is the coming and deep revelation. It'll take a long time to be revealed, but at least we begin to respond to it. It is the secret of life itself and is known to him alone. It is in its initial phase of this new expression, it works through the Manu and the Master Moria. It is that which veils the central mystery which all esoteric schools, if true to their inaugurating impulse, will eventually reveal. What it is, we do not know, but it is hinted at in Rule 13. We'll get to Rule 13 one fine day. So the will is going to reveal these basic mysteries which are found even in the kind of work we are doing, at the heart of the kind of educational mystery school work we are doing. There's something very first ray at the heart of this entire Moria Federation work, which is just presently a little reflection of what a real mystery school one day will be, when the mysteries are revealed again during the Aquarian Age. So, the burning, purifying, destructive effects of monadic will upon its distorted reflection, the individual will, its shadow, so to speak, deeply deserves consideration. So I guess we have to assess, how does our personal will work? When we will, how do we will? Do we follow the will of the soul? And is there anything in our whole system which somehow reflects monadic will? Anything we do consciously, purposefully, expertly, that actually reflects monadic will. The burning, purifying, destructive effects of the monadic will upon its distorted reflection, the individual will deeply deserves consideration. Now, usually it is said that the soul is the reflection of the monad, and the personality is the shadow of the monad. And here he is talking about individual will as a distorted reflection. And this seemed an important statement too. Let's see how much farther we have to go in order to complete this section. Not too bad. We will complete it today. We will complete it. I included here as well another statement about will, which is very important. The esoteric significance of tension, as far as I can explain it by limiting words, is focused, immovable will. Tension, focused, immovable will. And thus I stand, right? Within the fire of mind, focused within the head's clear light, let the group stand in a focused, immovable way. Right tension is the identification of brain and soul with the will aspect, and the preservation of that identification, unchanged and immovable, no matter what the circumstances and the difficulties. So we've been talking about the trained use of the higher will, receiving it, applying it correctly, and that requires holding a certain point of tension. So when the will comes through, we focus it. We do not move from what the will indicates, and we keep the alignment of brain, soul, and monad, no matter what's going on around us, oblivious of time and space, filled with the sense of essential being, driven by the will to good, and thus overcoming evil. Trying to put all those ideas together that we have been studying. You know how it's often said soul, mind, and brain, but now we have another alignment, soul, mind, brain, yes, and monad, which is reflected, of course, in Atma, spiritual will. And you know, sometimes you can visualize these things and it makes it happen. You know, in Esoteric Psychology 1, DK gives us three fusion formulas for rays 1, 2, and 3, and he gives us monad, soul, personality, chakra. He gives an alignment for each one of those aspects of the soul which must infuse us. You know how it goes. Isolated unity, how do you get isolated unity? Inclusive reason, what do you do? Presented attributes, what do you do? It all comes from the monad, and he gives us the alignment that we should visualize in order to bring through those particular qualities. Are there any questions up to this point? Okay, what have we been talking about this morning? What is our theme? The burning ground has not... It was the burning ground. And what have we been saying? That the burning ground isn't just the mind at work analyzing the lower worlds and causing friction. It's not just fire, suffering, horror, everything going on as the world is blowing up. It's something else. It is the monadic will, focused into the personality via the antikarana, causing a sequential and steady burning up of all obstacles. And are we, and so then the question is, are we on the burning ground? Actually. And I would say that one of the best ways to get there, in the way he defines it now, is to do the antikarana work, which creates the line of light down which that will power must descend. Then Then when the high, see, we don't expect, oh, now I'm going to receive the energies of the triad. Oh, here comes the monad too. What is it saying to me? You know, so it's so powerful that if we actually open the door and create this line of descent, it will have a hugely disruptive effect upon our life. And why is that? It's just like the planet Uranus, isn't it? Because Uranus is the planet of electric fire. It's a basically monadic planet. And it's the planet of the archetypes. And you know how it is? Uranus says, not your conditioning, not the pattern you've got, but my pattern. Uranus says, I am the authentic pattern. I don't care what you have created down here. You know, with I don't care how you've been conditioned. We're going to break up your conditioning so that the patterns you are living in the lower world are now the patterns which reflect the archetype. So the minute we create a line down which the monadic will can descend, we have to be ready for the breaking up of our conditioning. Now, do you think we're conditioned? We have patterns, don't we? DK calls it personality tradition. And he says you have to break up this personality tradition. Now, is there anything to do with comfort? Is comfort related to personality tradition? Oh, I'm not comfortable doing that. Well, you know, no, that's not who I am. It's not how I, you know, all that stuff. It is not a comfortable thing to be exposed to the monadic will, because personality tradition is going to be really rearranged. If not destroyed, then purified. So we have to be ready for that. So when we're building the Antikrana, this is like knocking on a door and there's a fire-breathing dragon behind the door. Please open. Trick or treat, you know, whatever. Open the door. And down it comes. I just thought, you know, I don't know what we're having for lunch, but I just felt inspired to say something like that before lunch. Okay. Are there any questions or complaints? Any complaints which you won't voice? I have a complaint because nothing of what I'm saying is being recorded. That is my complaint. I mean, it's being recorded, but it's, you know, it'll be like, like that. I don't understand it. I'll have to consult my technical expert. So we'll come back to this. We'll go to the middle of the book again after lunch, and then we'll finish this particular sentence. The burning ground has done its work. I guess the thing for each of us to figure out is whether we want to submit ourselves to the kind of burning ground that's being described here. Now, I would say also that the more we serve and the more there is a demand upon us for service, the more the Antikrana bridge will shape up. So he said somewhere that service is even more effective than meditation. Amazing. You know, it's even more invocative of your higher nature than meditation is. Okay. All right. Farewell, the burning ground has done its work. Okay. Okay, we'll be coming back. I'll say 5 minutes to 2:00.